Hi, I'm Shadow Stevens. While I'm doing this and that and the other thing at the very same time, I'm having a great time on The Jeremiah Show, the greatest show in the history of the world. For the love of God, subscribe. No, seriously, subscribe.
It's The Jeremiah Show. Tearing back the curtain on the hospitality, music, and entertainment industry with insider tips and the hottest global guests in the biz. With Dr. D and special LA personal development commentator Mike Gormley. He's a restaurant and bar fixture, a partner with legendary rock star drummer Mick Fleetwood in Fleetwood's on Front Street in Maui, and he's your radio host. And now, from a race around the sun, Jeremiah Higgins.
Welcome to the Jeremiah Show. I wanted to give a special welcome. We're so happy to have Kat back on the show. You were almost not able to make it, Kat, today. You're in Austin, Texas, and you were rescued there in the snowstorm and no heat, no power, no water. You are what a professional, eh, Richard?
Well, you know, it would have been the first time that any one of our hosts or guests could have claimed a snow day on the Jeremiah Show.
I feel like Julia Roberts being rescued by my Richard Gere.
You should give him another plug here now that we're actually recording, Kat, and that was very nice of your friend
to
rescue you.
Yes, so I have friends called Steve and Jen Rawson. They are a beautiful couple that I met at the dog park, which is my new social life because of COVID. Anyway, they are wonderful people and they've become my friends, and I was texting with Jen and I was telling, she was checking on me, and I was like, well, I got my car open. I got the ice off of my door so I could get in my car and feel some heat and charge up my phone. She's like, Steve is coming to get you. so he came and picked me up in his big truck.
Your kids were not with you?
No, they're hanging with their dad and they have heat.
And they have heat, that's good.
They're staying there, yeah.
Well, we're glad you're here. We're glad you're safe, Kat. And so welcome back to the show. And what a trooper again. 2 hours, you've been rescued within an hour and a half, 2 hours, and you're here.
Yeah, I tell you, kudos to Kat. I'm glad you didn't do something that somebody else in Texas tried. Now, it's not likely you're going to have a real serious problem, but it is going to create a problem because somebody apparently thought it would be a great idea to try to melt the snow by pouring gasoline on the snow and lighting it on fire.
Oh, boy.
Now, it's not going to spread very far, but it's still a stupid idea.
Very, very bad idea. There are some bad ideas out there.
Yes,
that's definitely one of the top of the list. So we've got Morgan all the way from Philadelphia. And Morgan, last time you checked in, welcome back. You won the Beatles trivia contest. And
my nemesis.
And yeah, so you're back. You're
the Cat was on my team.
Yeah.
The reigning champ.
That's right. By the way, that free Beatles haircut is coming.
Yeah, I've actually been waiting.
Okay. Morgan, how warm is it? And last time we talked to you, it was 9 degrees in Pittsburgh. And
watch yourself.
Today it's 25, so it's actually kind of warm.
Ooh. Oh,
again.
I wore shorts to school. Yeah.
Nice. And I do, if you're watching the Zoom video here, you've got some great Beatles records and posters behind you.
I had this in front of it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very cool.
I got that when I was like 8 or something.
Well, you're going to love this show.
It's been on my wall.
We have such a special guest today. I love this quote. I've got a couple quotes here I wanted to read that made me think of Ivor Davis, our very special guest. Here's one. Here's number one. He was born in fury and he lived in lightning. Tom came headlong into life. He was a giant in joy and enthusiasms. He didn't discover the world as and its people. He created them, which is from John Steinbeck. I love this. This is always a good one. Curiouser and curiouser from Alice. Journalists report on the story. They are hardly ever the story. Today's going to be an exception to that rule, if our special guest will allow us. Mm. Author, journalist, best-selling author, and investigative reporter, Ivor Davis is the story today. He is a journalist, and in my opinion, quite a famous journalist. He has covered pop culture and iconic figures throughout his 60-plus years in journalism as a writer for such massive and iconic papers as The Express and The Times of London. His incredible body of work encompasses nearly every corner of pop culture, writing and interviewing everyone from the Beatles to Charles Manson, from Tom Cruise to Mariel Hemingway to Robin Williams. He penned a weekly entertainment column for the New York Times Syndicate for over 15 years. There, again, he interviewed some of the biggest names in show business. Cary Grant, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Muhammad Ali, just a few of the names on the long list. Again, I go to another quote. Albert Einstein explained his genius when he famously said, "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious." And again, I have a feeling that Ivor Davis may relate to some of these quotes. Welcome, Ivor Davis, to the show. We're so happy to have you today.
Wow, I'm a bit bowled over by that intro. That was the most spectacular literary intro I've ever had in my life.
Oh, come
on. Are you for hire? Can I hire you?
Yeah, I probably borrowed that all from you somehow. Have you always been a curious person?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about a journalist is that you, I was fairly shy as a young man, but you know, as a journalist, you can actually ask rude and intrusive questions without being punched in the nose. And I found, wow, that's great. And I enjoyed it. And most of the people I spoke to in my career never punched me in the nose. And they answered the question.
I was going to say, you enjoyed the part where you did not get punched in the nose. That part you enjoyed?
Exactly.
Yeah, perfect. Exactly. And so that's how you got your start. It's as simple as that.
Yes.
That's great. As a boy, how were you? Did you love the Hardy Boys? Did you love mysteries? Were you, describe, you know, how you got the bug as a writer, or as a just a curious, aside from avoiding being punched in the nose and getting the answers.
Very briefly, I wanted to be either a detective or a journalist when I was a kid in my early teens. And they said, well, to be a policeman, you need to be 5'9" tall. And I said, well, that there goes that career. And then I was stuck being a journalist, and I became a journalist. And it was just serendipity, because I ended up coming to America. I ended up running a bureau for a big London newspaper. I am a oh lucky man. Remember that song, Oh Lucky Man? That's me.
Mm. I do. How did you get involved with the Beatles? And we've got to spend some time on this. We do have, as I said, we have the Beatles self-proclaimed biggest fan out there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the winner of our last contest, Morgan. So we definitely want to spend a little time talking about your book and your time with the Beatles. How did you meet them, Ivor?
Well, To make it very brief, because I'm dying to hear how we have such a young expert on the Beatles, because it boggles the mind. And she's, you know, Morgan, you're the whiz kid, aren't you? Yes, you are.
I mean, you could say that, maybe.
She'll take it.
Well, in 30 words or less, I was in Los Angeles, 1964, my editor called me, said, "The boys are arriving in San Francisco. Get there quickly." I said, "Who are the boys?" He said, "The Beatles, silly." And I didn't know much about them. I'd seen them on the Ed Sullivan Show in February 1964, when Morgan and Kat weren't even a grin in their parents' eyes. I mean, their parents were at kindergarten at the time. Anyway, I'm going off key. So I jumped on the plane, landed in San Francisco, met by absolute bedlam, screaming young women, And then I was off and running on a Beatle trip that at the time I appreciated, but I didn't realize the historical significance, and neither did the Beatles. And that's the brief, succinct, I hope, answer.
How old are you at that point?
I was 26, and the Beatles were much younger. They were 21, 22.
Wow.
So they were a few years younger than me.
So they were the boys.
They were the boys.
Do you think that helped not knowing? You knew of them. You knew, right, I would imagine, but you didn't really know a lot about them. Do you think that helped in your writing, in your observations, and just being there, that you weren't as taken up maybe right away at first by their fame?
I mean, I think so. But don't forget, the Beatles weren't as huge as they are now. They suddenly grew and grew like Topsy. They became gigantic. And so they were also fairly nervous because they were desperate, and Brian Epstein, their manager, was desperate for them to be a success in America. All the other British rock and roll stars came over to America and vanished in the smoke. But the Beatles suddenly discovered that they were red hot. And so they were fairly, they were nice. And I was kind of entombed, embedded with them. They couldn't go out, and they were stuck with me. So they had to get on with me. Otherwise, it would have been 5 weeks of hell.
So you were almost like that writer in Almost Famous, in that movie, mm-hmm. Almost Famous, where you were not the young guy, but you were on the tour with them, and I would imagine the buses, the planes, the hotel rooms, 34 days. And their North American tour. I want Morgan to kind of take over here a little bit. She's got so many great questions for you and wants to know so much, so she can add to her title, her crown.
Yeah, to my knowledge. Yes, I have a few questions. So my first one is, whenever you met them and you were hanging out with them, which Beatle surprised you the most with their personality, and what about them surprised you?
Well, the first person I met was John in the hotel room in San Francisco. Derek Taylor, their press agent, took me in to meet them. And they were absolutely, he introduced me to John, and John and Paul and George and the other guy, forget his name now, were watching television, watching themselves arrive at San Francisco airport. And when they introduced me to the Beatles all uniformly grunted. I mean, it wasn't. But then once we got used to each other and they knew that I was okay, whatever that meant, John was wicked and provocative and funny, irreverent. And he was terrific. He liked to needle me, and he liked to needle everyone. Paul was a charming guy. Paul used to, on our private jet, which I fortunately traveled with them, he would serve me gin and tonics, you know, and I didn't even give him a tip. So that was that. Now, Ringo was Ringo. Ringo, I don't know how many drummers you know, Morgan, but drummers aren't that loquacious. Drummers, they save their energy for beating the heck out of the drum. So that was Ringo. And then, of course, there was George. And the problem was I was writing George Harrison's column, ghostwriting it. George didn't have much to say. Now, in later years, as you all know, George became a great songwriter and a star in his own right. But believe me, back then in 64, George was, I mean, people call him the quiet one. He was pretty sullen. He didn't have much to say. He had a good sense of humor. So there were four diverse characters all stuck in America on this wonderful road trip that was a huge success.
That's so cool how they're all different, but they all came together. Well, my other question kind of goes along with that, and it was, whenever you think of each member individually, what's the most memorable thing that happened with them that comes to mind?
Well, I wrote George's column, and George wasn't very communicative. And for the first two columns, because he went to bed at 3 a.m. and woke 3 p.m, he didn't get a chance to tell me what was on his mind. So I wrote his column. And I must admit, it was rubbish, total rubbish. So he suddenly obviously heard from London. We were on the plane. He said, I need to talk to you. He said, your column that you've written under my name is a load of old, and he used a strong word that I won't use, but rubbishy. And I said, George, get up in the morning, talk to me, tell me what's going on in your mind, and then at least that way I'll be able to write something that you like. And we got on much better after that. Ringo, as I said, didn't have that much to say. And the only thing I remember about Ringo was in Montreal, Canada in 1964, there was a death threat and Ringo was terrified. There was a French separatist who threatened Ringo. I don't know why. Oh, yes, he threatened Ringo because they said, you ready for this? We're gonna kill the Jew. Well, Ringo was not Jewish. Seriously.
Yeah.
And he wasn't. So Ringo sat in that concert, and I remember he was terrified. He tried to crouch under the drums and under the cymbals and under during the whole concert while security men were hidden just beneath the stage, just in case. So John, of course, John was John. I mean, he liked to needle you. I said my name was Ivor. He said, Ivan. I said, Ivor. He said, you're Ivan the Terrible. And from then on, he called me Ivan. So that was that. And Paul was a sweetie pie. And Paul today is still a sweetie pie. I saw him last year. He is charming. And he was always charming. So that's a brief summation. I was going to throw the question back to you and say, you know, which Beatle do you like? But do we have time to ask Morgan what Beatle she likes?
Of course, of course.
I would say that my favorite is probably John. I it's kind of like a tie between John and Paul. I saw Paul, and he was like 2012. I saw him in concert. But John's been my favorite. I used to watch like little Beatles documentaries all the time. And John just always came across as like the funny and outgoing one. He's always witty in interviews and stuff that I saw. So I'm sure that he did the same thing with you. And I just thought that that was like unique. And actually I'm doing an art project right now in ceramics and we have to like sculpt someone's face and I'm doing John. So hopefully it turns out good, but yeah, he's my favorite, I think.
That's a very good evaluation. You've hit the nail on the head. You've got it.
Cat.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, do you have another question? I know you have a million questions.
I have a couple more. Well, the one you were talking about how when you first met them, you said there was a bunch of young women going crazy. So of like what you can remember, what was the craziest encounter with a fan that you've ever seen?
Well, what happened was, I mean, everybody wanted to get up and hold their hand. And I got fathers approaching me and I got mothers approaching me. And that's another story for another time. But anyway, so I mean, the main thing was that the girls were desperate to meet them. I mean, it was simply that, and the Beatles were not averse to meeting young women. But the problem was with the young fans, as you may have heard, that when I sat down in the front row and I went to every concert, every one of theirs, and sometimes twice a day. As soon as the Beatles started to sing, you couldn't hear a word because it took me about 4 weeks or 3 weeks to discover when they sang, I want to hold your, what do you call it? I don't know what it was. And then I realized, I mean, but the noise level was furious. So
could they even hear themselves play?
No. They could not hear themselves play, and Ringo became a good lip reader because he thought they were playing A Hard Day's Night, and they were not playing A Hard Day's Night.
It didn't matter.
Seriously, that was it. That was what went on. And I must tell you one thing about fans, Morgan. So I met years later a lady who was a Bonwit teller, head of their department, and she said, I was in love with Paul. I said, how do you know? You know, and he was in love with me, she said. Ah, how do you know that? She said, well, I went to 3 concerts, and I want to tell you that when I smiled and waved at Paul, he waved back. Well, of course he did. So, I mean, that was in their minds, in the fans' minds. Anyway, that was the fun of the trip.
Wow.
There's a story about Bob Dylan that I think is pretty interesting. Bob Dylan join them and taught them a few things.
Bob Dylan was the Beatles loved him. John loved him. And one day in New York, just before the end of the tour, I saw this scruffy looking guy, kind of semi-shaven with a big backpack on his back, coming into the hotel in New York City. And it was Bob Dylan. And we were having a party in the next room. And then Bob Dylan went into the room with the Beatles. They put down wet towels on the door. And Bob Dylan proceeded to pull out a very high-grade fat cigarette, which actually looked to me like it was like a tampon. I mean, anyway, so he gave this fat cigarette to Ringo.
You got it from Bob Marley.
Because that Jamaican stuff.
Or Snoop Dogg.
Or Snoop Dogg, yeah.
There you go. Anyway, long story short, the door opens and Ringo is rolling around the floor giggling. And I look in there and I say, what happened to Ringo? And they say, well, Ringo took Bob's cigarette and he smoked the whole thing. He didn't realize that the protocol, and all of us know what the protocol on sharing cigarettes is that you take a few puffs and you pass it around. Ringo didn't know that. Suffered hilariously for it. And that was Bob Dylan's vision of visit to the Beatles in New York City in the late summer of 64.
I'm sure there are so many stories, so many late nights, and I was really shocked that you guys actually played Monopoly. I don't know if that's code for something, because it's like saying we played Go Fish or read the Bible. Sure, but we'll be right back. We got to take a real quick break. We're talking with author, journalist, investigative reporter, best-selling author, Ivor Davis. It's such a fascinating conversation. We've got Morgan joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we've got Kat, who made it out of her home without heat to join us in Austin, Texas. Dr. D there. We got the whole group here. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for more from Ivor Davis.
First, I'd like to invite those listening and watching today to my next Zoom Live program, part of a series called Ivor Davis Up Close and Personal With. I get a chance to talk with some of the greatest talents in our talent-rich community. Previous guests have included Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Chris Hillman and the legendary British actor Malcolm McDowell. You can still go to YouTube and you can watch those programs by hitting venturamuseum.org. Great guests, great entertainment. Next up, on February the 25th at 6:30, my guest is the remarkably versatile Southern California lawyer, teacher, and concert pianist Miriam Arachea. You can watch live, go onto the museum website, and I hope to see you that night.
This is Ann Haitch, and you're listening to The Jeremiah Show. We are Ann
and Heather,
and we are better together. Listen to us every Thursday.
Cheers.
My name's Danny Trejo, and you're listening to The Jeremiah Show. And on it, I'm talking about my cookbook. It's awesome. Hey, I got a documentary coming out and dropped a record called Satisfy My Soul. Check it out. Trejo's music. Jeremiah, you're loved, Holmes.
Hi, I'm Mariel Hemingway, founder of the Dead Poets Foundation. When emotional pain and the struggles of life drive anyone to purposely end their own life, the impact is beyond tragic. The hurt and loss touches all of us forever. Dead Poets Foundation is conceived and dedicated to helping people move away from the impulses of self-destruction toward the hope and blessings of life. We are striving to end the stigma around mental health and have fewer people die by suicide. Addressing all aspects of the tragedy of suicide through art, publication, event panel discussion, and advocacy, the mission of Dead Poets Foundation is to inspire and equip all of us for living. Dead Poets Foundation is a place to come to for expression, creativity, and discovery to help people choose to live with desire and purpose. Please visit deadpoetsfoundation.org and join the movement. If we save one life, we save the world. And join us in September when we collectively light a candle for life and create a worldwide Ring of Fire. The global Ring of Fire event featuring music, a celebrity panel, and a worldwide celebration of life broadcast around the world from Santa Barbara, California, hosted by me, Mariel Hemingway, Nico Carpinelli, and The Jeremiah Show. DeadPoetsFoundation.org.
Welcome back. We're here with Ivor Davis. He just incredible. I'm speechless to even describe you as far as what you've done, how many books you've written, and we're jumping back in with some questions for you. Being back there during that time with the Beatles, which was so revolutionary, right? What do you think is the difference with music today? Just how would you compare, having seen that kind of revolution with the Beatles and then also obviously listening to what's popular these days, for you, like, how big is the chasm between those things? And what do you personally feel like is different, or, you know, would you categorize it as sort of missing? What's your opinion on music today?
I don't think there's anything missing, Kat. I think you've got to realize the amazing thing is that people, when I go to conventions, they have the grandfathers, they have the grandmothers, they have the parents, they have the kids and the grandchildren who like Beatle music. So the songbook of the Beatles is still so evergreen, even today. People love that music. They've written songs that live on. Brian Epstein said, who was the Beatles' manager, said to me that the Beatles will be big in the 21st century. I thought he was full of you-know-what, but he was right. So their music is just lives on. It just is unbelievable. And you can stop anyone in the street and you can probably, maybe I'm wrong, you can say, well, what's your favorite Beatles song? And they'll tell you, whatever the age is, Kat.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? What's the magic secret sauce? Is it just the, like, is there a thread woven in between, like, through each song in the way that Paul and John tended to write together?
Heard that it's a subliminal message in the background saying, follow the Beatles, follow the Beatles.
But you know how music can have like there's math okay. to it, and there's like certain like hooks, and there's like math to it. Do you think there's anything like that as far as just why they happen to be the ones that are so universal and kind of forever?
I think you could get Sherlock Holmes, who was a detective way back then, to investigate that. But the answer is probably not. And the reason I say probably not, Kat, is because look at the songs, the ones we hear today. I Want to Hold Your Hand, all that kind of bubblegum music was okay at the time. Hard Day's Night, lovely. And then they evolved thanks to the brilliance of producer George Martin. And look at the old, you know, Eleanor Rigby, and look at all the other stuff. I mean, I was listening to Paul, I think, during Wings singing My Valentine last week. And what a song that is. So Fake somehow hit the nerve with such an assortment of songs. It's unbelievable. Mm.
Let me ask this question, something I've thought about, and I hope you answer honestly to it. It's going to be probably tough for you to do that, but a journalist, you know, you were, I guess, assigned to the Beatles and their North American tour. It was so, as you said, their manager, Brian Epstein, it was so important to them that they were popular here, that America embraced them and all that. You followed them. You were the person that for the entire tour was with them. Every show, every minute, pretty much, you were with them, and you crafted this story. And you craft, in a way, I mean, the journalists sometimes don't get enough credit, where you build a brand almost. You build up their image. You help the stories. You help put them in the spotlight and make them cool as well. You know, it's a part of the equation. Wouldn't you think that sometimes journalists are star makers? And I won't go so far to say that you made the Beatles, but you did help that North American tour, that how they were perceived, how they were, you know, the story that followed them. And do you agree that it's important, and that it's part of
a millimeter of whatever happened? I mean, most of my stories, frankly, were all about the way the Beatles were conquering America. This is what I knew my editors and the readers wanted to know. But I mean, their body of work, their history today, 50 odd years later, it speaks for itself. And no single person, Brian Epstein, when he found them, can really take responsibility for the huge success that they enjoyed and continue to enjoy.
The soundtrack today, we've done a few Beatles shows in the past, and we've used Beatles music. And so I thought with this show, when I put the soundtrack together, let's do covers of the Beatles songs by some of these great musicians. So you're right. You're absolutely right. When you ask about a Cat, you know, what the influences just go on. And you've got The Cure, you know, you doing Hello Goodbye on the soundtrack. We've got Motley Crue doing Helter Skelter, Amy Winehouse, All My Lovin', Fiona Apple, Across the Universe, Kurt Cobain, Ray Charles, Emmylou Harris. I mean, so many musicians, almost all of them have covered the Beatles, and it just continues to grow. This, their catalog, their library, their music finds new fans through new musicians and old and talented musicians. It's just incredible. It's incredible that you had that 38 days, right, with them?
Yes.
How amazing. We got to take another quick break here. We're with author, journalist, investigative reporter Ivor Davis. Really fascinating conversation on his life and some of the things that he's been involved in history. We'll be right back. Go check out, pick up a book from Ivor Davis, and we'll be right back.
Please let me tell you about my assorted books, which you can learn about by going to my website, ivordavisbooks.com. Now, if you like the Beatles, and who doesn't, you will adore The Beatles and Me on Tour, my inside story about my travels with the Beatles when they made rock and roll history by conquering America in the summer of 64. I was there and there were no barriers, playing Monopoly with John, ghostwriting George Harrison's column, and Ringo in Canada when he ran into a spot of bother. And oh yes, the other Beatle, what's his name? Oh, Paul McCartney, a great guy, traveling in his private jet, where I loved it when he served me a gin and tonic and didn't even demand a tip.
Close your eyes, and I'll kiss you to my then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day, and I'll say all my loving to you. I'll pretend that I'm kissing the
Hey, it's Tim Stack here, and I just did the Jeremiah Show and had a really, really great time. Check me out at TV's Tim Stack on Twitter.
Welcome back to the Jeremiah Show. Our special guest today, Ivor Davis. He covered Robert Kennedy's 1968 presidential bid and was in the Ambassador Hotel the night Kennedy was assassinated. He was one of the boys on the bus chronicling the life of actor turned politician Ronald Reagan, first in his campaign for governor of California, then for president. What an amazing life. What an amazing career. Aside from all the famous people that you've interviewed, you've been in the Watts riots. You were there. You've been front line for many of the world's most historic events, Ivor. Can you comment on a couple? Robert Kennedy and the assassination and being at the Ambassador Hotel.
Well, everybody knows about that terrible night. And I was covering Bobby Kennedy, and he was on the track to become the next president. At least he was on the track to be the Democrats' number one candidate. And Bobby Kennedy was phenomenal. I mean, he had energy. And when he arrived in L.A. That terrible day, he didn't know it was going to be a terrible day. His hands were raw, I noticed, because people wanted to touch him and hold him, he had that charisma, same as his brother. So the night at the Ambassador Hotel, very briefly, was that he delivered his sort of victory speech. Then he was going to go in and have a press conference with the journalists, and we followed him through the kitchen, and I heard 4 or 5 or 6 balloons popping. I thought there were balloons popping. Then screaming, and then I pushed my way into the pantry, and I'll never forget the sight of Bobby lying bleeding on the floor with Ethel nestling his head and trying to put his head on one of those straw campaign hats. And people were screaming. It was bedlam. It was horrendous. And we didn't know it at that moment, but Bobby, of course, hours later was pronounced dead. Crazy, awful, an image you don't easily forget.
No. some of the experiences are tragic like that experience. Some are on a private plane with the Beatles, some and experiencing a time in history that is so well marked, but you were there front line. Spending time with Ronald Reagan on his tour, you know, to become president and governor and then president. What was that like? I mean, there's so many differences. And as a journalist, how did you get to that? Was it pure talent? Did you push your, you know, into these stories, or did you happen upon them? What do you think?
Well, again, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but basically my assignment being on the West Coast was to cover the big stories. And we had a bureau in Washington, we had a bureau in New York, but on the West Coast, there was just me, which was very lucky. But Ronald Reagan, I mean, he wasn't the greatest politician, but he knew how to talk. He knew how to tell a joke. He was an easygoing guy. I don't think he was the greatest president, but for somebody who's come from showbiz, unlike some other people who came from showbiz, Reagan was brilliant. He could deliver a sentence. He could tell a joke, and he didn't hog the limelight. He knew when to leave the stage, and that was his charm. And he was a charming guy. And I saw him in a movie which he played a killer. Would you believe an old movie called The Killers? Look it up. It is hilarious when you see Ronald Reagan, our former president, playing a killer in a movie.
Is there a moment you can share on the bus with him that was something that you have remembered, something maybe he said, a way that he was, or a personal moment that you were able to share in memory of him? I mean, he's so beloved and worldwide, but in Santa Barbara especially, I think.
Well, I'll tell you the Santa Barbara connection, which was kind of a bit sad, and I didn't mean to be sad again, but we had gone to see Ronnie at the Santa Barbara Ranch. It was a rainy day, and we got up to the ranch, and Ronnie was standing there with Nancy. And the press suddenly asked him questions. And they asked him a question about the Iran-Contra situation. I forget what the question was. And Ronnie stood with Nancy. When the question was asked, Ronnie, standing in his ranch, looked perplexed, and Nancy nudged him. I was 6 feet away, and she said, "We're doing what we can." And Ronnie said, "We're doing what we can." And I knew from that moment that, you know, the end of Ronald Reagan, I mean, Ronald was in early stage problems, mental problems. And that was an image of a man who was very vibrant and used to hand out jelly beans on the bus. That was kind of unusual.
What was your favorite jelly bean flavor?
Do you remember? Go ahead, ask the girls.
You're not a jelly bean fan, huh? Morgan, what are you?
Not
what are
particularly.
You,
no.
Probably the red ones. Anything but yellow. I don't like yellow.
Popcorn. Jelly belly.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to give you this 10-second story. Jelly beans. The Beatles. George Harrison says he loves jelly beans. He loves the soft jelly beans, not the hard American jelly beans. I'm sitting in the front row, and all these young women are pelting George with hard jelly beans. And I had a neck that is still scarred to this very day from hard jelly beans. And when I see you next, I'll show you the scars.
No wonder you didn't want to answer that question. You don't like jelly beans. Are you telling me we need to take another break? This will be our last break, right?
That's correct.
We're going to take one more break. We're talking with Ivor Davis. This is so much fun. We might come visit you down there in Ventura, yeah. Ivor, and just spend the afternoon listening to stories. A couple of the great books that he's authored and penned, The Beatles and Me, on tour. And also, we've got to talk about Ladies and Gentlemen, The Penguins, a children's book, which is fascinating that what can't you do? We'll be right back. More with Ivor Davis.
My latest book, Manson Exposed, a reporter's 50-year journey into madness and murder, recounts my personal story from day one of the murder of the beautiful actress Sharon Tate and her friends, a brutality that brought the 60s to such a shocking end. I was there from day one. I covered Charles Manson's circus of a trial, and I interviewed and got to know some of the key figures during that awful time. This book, again, is my personal take of covering that atrocious story. If you can read my book, it's in audio, and you can go to IvorDavisBooks.com.
Brooke Williamson, Top Chef, season 14 winner, and you're listening to The Jeremiah Show, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Jeremiah Show with Dr. D. Find all of our past shows on iTunes, podcasts, The Jeremiah Show.
Welcome back to The Jeremiah Show. We've got Kat from Austin, Texas, Morgan from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dr. D's from three feet away, and Ivor Davis, he is joining us from Ventura, California.
But just so people don't get the wrong idea, there is plexiglass between us.
Yes.
Okay? Okay.
With holes in it, like the bank. So I don't know if it's working, Dr. D. Ivor Davis joins us, as I said, from Ventura, and I just wanted to, you have lived there pretty much a long time, a lot of your life, and it's one of those towns that reminds me a little bit of like Potrero Hill up in San Francisco. You know, you got some hills, you got some great architecture. It's one of those little gems that you'd probably like to keep that way, that's kind of not known as well. A lot of people drive by it on the freeway, but it's such a beautiful town. I know it's your hometown right now, and you love it. Do you want to say something nice about Ventura?
Well, I would say that if anybody is driving up the freeway towards Santa Barbara, keep going.
So you know what? So we shouldn't talk about it.
The problem now is,
tell people.
In a year, Jeremiah, in a year of coronavirus, the refugees from L.A. are heading to Ventura. It's a great community. It is rich with talent. My museum program that I did my commercial for is terrific because we have so many talented people. I mean, I'm not saying Santa Barbara is lacking talent. You know what I mean? And probably Austin has quite a few people that are quite good.
Yeah.
I'm not too sure about other towns, but anyway, Ventura is a great town.
That's it.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Over 60 years writing, you know, authoring books, writing, and being in journalism, you've seen a lot, like we've stated. You've seen it all pretty much. Before we talk about the Manson book and the murders, briefly, I wanted to ask you, you've seen such a long, you've seen politics and a lot of the issues, you know, from civil rights to women's rights and on and on. Those have, a lot of those have changed voting rights in your career, Ivor, and seeing where we are at today, what was that? What's that like for you? Is it more of the same? Do you think we're progressing? Do you think we've, what's your comment on the state of the world as you've seen so many things good happen, but so many things backslide? What's your comment on
well,
the world
I
right
now? Well, I sincerely hope that we are on a new perpetual solid track today, because it's true. Way back, I covered the race riots. I covered the Watts riots. It was terrible. And covering the Watts riots in 1966 reminded me, it brought back a kind of deja vu feeling when people were writing earlier last year, 2020, and the looting that was going on in LA reminded me of the horrible Watts riots. So things have changed, and I hope they stay changed. But in a way, it's almost like the constant nightmare. You wake up and it's happening again. But yeah. I hope, and I'm an optimistic guy, believe me, I think you have to be optimistic to live in the world that we live in. I hope that we are on the right track, finally.
Me too. One story, one big story that left an indelible mark on your journalism career, that's the notorious Manson family murders. You were deeply embedded in the life of Charles Manson. The crimes happened over 50 years ago, August 8th and 9th, 1969, one of the most brutal murders in history. How were you embedded and how did you get involved? You covered the big stories of the day, but can you tell us a little bit about how that came about and how you've continued to write about, you know, a few couple books?
Well, from day one, they sent me to a house in Beverly Hills in a canyon, which was the home of Sharon Tate. And then the whole story unfolded. It became awful. You learned of the deaths. And then you learned the deaths of the LaBianca family 24 hours later. And then 3.5, 4 months later, they named Charles Manson, who nobody had ever heard of, as the killer. And they said he lived at the Spahn Movie Ranch. And so I went immediately, as any reporter would do, out to the Spahn Movie Ranch. And they actually, those involved in the killings were in jail. And then I met a couple of Manson disciples who were quite friendly to me, and they told me this amazing story, which I sat there boggle-headed, unbelievable, that Manson fed his followers marijuana and all sorts of mind-altering drugs. And what did he do? He played them songs from the Beatles' White Album, Helter Skelter, Revolution, stuff like that. And they told me genuinely in their minds that Manson preached that the Beatles were sending secret messages to him in the lyrics of that album, in those songs, to say there was going to be a revolution, blacks against whites, the whole country would be wiped out, and Manson would escape to the desert with his followers. Well, when I heard that story, knowing a little bit about the Beatles, I just thought, what a load of old tosh, what rubbish. And then a year later, the district attorney presented the same thesis to the jury. And guess what? The jury believed it. And guess what? The jury convicted. So the Beatles came back again. And when I spoke to the Beatles about it, John said, what's Helter Skelter got to do with stabbing anyone? I mean, it was the most outrageous thesis.
Wow.
Mm. Morgan.
Yeah.
What do you think about all this? Well, did you know much about?
I've like actually recently kind of learned about the connections. I actually watched a movie on Monday. It's the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
Like that. And I just thought that after I heard that connection, that it was kind of bizarre. And that's not something that I would ever like make that link to in my head.
I had that question. I'm glad you brought that up for you, Ivor. Is, you know, what was your take on Quentin Tarantino's the creative liberty that he took with that story as well? How much was true? How much was
Once upon a time, it is a giveaway. It's a story. It's a fairy story. Mm-hmm. And he did a great job, and he changed the ending dramatically. I'm not giving anything away. The film has been out for a long time. But the one thing when I saw the movie that kind of scared me and was eerie was when I saw how he recreated the Spahn movie ranch, a really decrepit movie ranch where Manson lived, and the girls, the Manson disciples. That was scary. And when I saw that, I thought, yes, that was the way I felt it was when I went there. There were these pretty young women saying, hello. I do not exaggerate. Almost sing-song. And then he created that in his film, and it was the Village of the Damned. Oh, scary, scary, scary. And that was the way it was.
Mm. Is that how it looked in real life, too?
Yes. It looked, he recreated the ranch exactly the way it was. Did a magnificent, I mean, the set design was perfecto.
Wow.
Kat, I know you're dying to talk about the children's book.
Oh, yeah. I want to hear about your children's book. The Penguins.
The Penguins. Well, thank you very much. ladies and gentlemen, The Penguins. And that was my kind of imitation of Ed Sullivan, which I'm not known for my imitations. But Ed Sullivan was the guy that introduced the Beatles. Ladies and gentlemen, The Beatles. Anyway,
oh, I remember that.
Terrible, terrible impersonation. And don't call me, I'll call you.
I get it.
So what happened was I was on a lecture tour and I stopped in the Falkland Islands, which is a British island where everybody speaks with an English accent. There were about 500 residents and about a million penguins. And I thought to myself, if the penguins squawk with an English accent, why not write a children's story about four penguins who want to be as big as the Beatles? And indeed, I did that. And the four penguins were called the Penguins. And their big first hit was I Want to Hold Your Flipper. And they were so successful that they got a call and they flew to New York because penguins can't fly. Penguins actually can swim. They flew on a jet, of course, to New York, and they appeared as top of the bill for the Ed Pelican Show.
I can't believe you didn't do an impersonation. You could probably, can you do, Richard loves the old TV shows and impersonations. You have
right
that one?
Here on our show, Topo Gigio.
Very good. Oh my God. Can you give me the Beatles introduction, Richard?
Go ahead. Right here on our stage, it's the Beatles.
Very good.
Not too shabby.
I'm not going to admit my age. So I'll be with Morgan and Kat here. We don't even know if that's right or not. We'll just give it to you.
It sounds good to me.
Oh, yeah, it sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Yeah. Ivor, what's the lesson in the book? Like, what's the story? What's the lesson?
Well, the thing is this: success and fame is wonderful, but your roots are what counts. Your family and what you're used to, because in my career I've covered so many movie stars and talked to people who are not happy campers. So the story at the end of it was that the Penguins, after their whirlwind success, want to go home and want to enjoy the joys of home. And that kind of is, you know, I'm not getting too sophisticated with the youngsters, but I love it. And I tell you one other quick thing. I also, my kids, my grandkids don't appreciate this, but the four penguins are called Sadie, Levi, Elias, and Ezra, which just happened to be the names of my grandchildren.
Oh, that's sweet.
A sweetheart. I'm going to get that book. My kids are 10 and 13, but I'm going to still.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I'm going to have to buy it just for myself.
Yeah.
you know, when I've done book readings, I think parents enjoy reading it as much as their kids.
Yeah.
I was going to say that I think children's books are great for adults. I think they're great lessons. It's great. You know, they're quick reads, fun to read. And it's even better if you have a child.
Hey, as an adult, I still like Rocky and Bullwinkle. I get those messages. I get them.
Ivor, it's been such a great hour with you, and Morgan really wanted to join the show today and meet you and talk to you a little bit. I think, Morgan, do you have a final question? We can let you finish off the show here, Ivor.
Yes, I do. Well, first, I just wanted to say I really appreciate getting to meet Ivor, and this has been just amazing, and every story he's told just sounds unreal. But my last question is, did the Beatles have a favorite song or a favorite set that they like to perform?
Well, that's a tough question because John and Paul wrote most of the music together and they like doing, I honestly think they like singing the ones they didn't perform. Roll Over Beethoven and Long Tall Sally, which they never wrote, but they were so influenced by the Black American singers that they loved those. And if you were to ask them, you know, what's your favorite song? I don't think they'd really come up with an answer. But I want to say, I hope that I'm going to finish with that answer. It's been so much fun. I want to hear more about life in Austin when normal service is resumed in Texas. Can't believe what's happening in Texas. I'd love to go to Austin. I've heard so much about it. And thank you very much for having me on. It's been great fun.
And I will make you a cup of PG Tips. That's what I'm drinking right now. I make a good cup of tea.
Thank you.
Before he left, too, I wanted to, your friend here says hello. You can see it in Zoom. Arthur Von Wiesenberg. Arthur at the station.
Arthur, is that with Arthur and his Oscar, or is that Arthur with his...
I don't know. It looks like an Oscar to me.
Arthur is such a... he's wonderful. I mean, you know Arthur.
Yeah, mutual friend here at the station. Owner of the station, yes. Yeah.
Wow.
So very, very good to have you. I would love to have you. I'm going to put it out here right now before we say goodbye and maybe tease the audience. I'd love to do a whole show around Halloween on the Manson, on your book, on the Manson murders. That would be really, if I could get you back. And we wanted to talk about Robin Williams too, but we'll do it on another show. So many great people that you've interviewed. Maybe we can have you back, Ivor, and talk more about that. I think you should definitely take that trip out to Austin and do a book reading out there. Kat will get you all hooked up.
Oh, yeah.
And Morgan, thanks so much for joining us with your great questions for Ivor. Everybody have a great week.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Communicate more, listen, and evolve. Have a great week.
Hello, everybody. You've heard enough of me. You want me to get out of town fast. But before I do, I just want to invite you to either come to one of my museum talks, Museum of Ventura County. Check out the website. If you want to hear anything more about my Beatle book, my Manson book, my children's book, particularly my children's book, go to ivordavisbooks.com and you will read more about me than you ever wanted to hear. Thank you and good night.
Day breaks, your mind aches. You find that all her words of kindness linger on. She no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time, doesn't feel. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears. Cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You want to and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. he doesn't need.
This is comedian Maj Chobrani, and you are listening to The Jeremiah Show on AM 1290 KZSB Santa Barbara. Listen, man.
Do you need help with your restaurant or hospitality business? See how we can help your business at hjlrestaurantadvisors.com. Check out our website at thejeremiahshow.com. We are on iTunes and SoundCloud. Please subscribe on iTunes, podcast The Jeremiah Show. Did you like our soundtrack? Find all of our soundtracks on Spotify, The Jeremiah Show. As always, a big thanks to Dr. D for making our voices come alive on the airwaves, and to our station manager, Les Carroll, for letting us on the airwaves at all. Be sure to check out our very own Richard Dr. D. Dugan's Peabody Award-nominated radio show, Tell Me Your Story, every Sunday at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. Thank you for listening to The Jeremiah Show with Dr. D. Listeners, we appreciate you and want to hear from you. Please send us your ideas at ShowJeremiah on Twitter and Instagram. The Jeremiah Show is produced by executive producer Jeremiah Higgins and sound engineer Richard Dr. D. Dugan. Have a great rest of your week, everyone. Evolve.
Red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors of red.
They were beautiful, the most beautiful sky in the sky.
On fire, the clouds will catch the colors.